Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of a Dhamma talk and Sangha discussion that introduces the Buddha's teachings and the Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. It includes a brief history of the Buddha and an overview of the Dhamma. This talk was presented on December 10th, 2016 at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. This talk concludes with meta-intentional meditation. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace.
So again, good morning, everyone. Today's the introductory class to our Dhamma study. How many of you have not read the book before, The Truth of Happiness?
I haven't read the book, is that what you said?
Yes. You haven't read it?
I've read part of it.
Okay. Erica? Okay, well, just to say, this course is based, what we're going to do for the next 10 to 12 weeks here on each Tuesday and Saturday is review that book and take the Dhamma study. Those of you that have actually been through the course with us, we did the same thing last year as a Sangha or have taken it otherwise, I think you'll find that this practice is always a practice of refining what we know. And so one of the things that you've probably gathered already is there's a lot of repetition in the teachings and how I teach, what I'm going to say today. If you've been to more than a half a dozen of my classes, you've probably heard me say it before. But that's common throughout the Pali Canon and throughout the way that the method that the Buddha used to teach. And the reason is the common human problem of conditioned thinking. We have resistance. It's an aspect of conditioned thinking to have a natural resistance to not understand something immediately that is unfamiliar to us. We resist it just because we don't have an identity with it yet. The more you hear something, the more it gets past that wall of conditioned thinking. As you continue, again, if you've been through this before, you'll probably have moments where you've heard something 10, 15, 20, 100 times, and it finally makes sense. Well, that's just how this works. You know, we're finally able to put it in the right context. Everything the Buddha taught for 45 years was in the context of the Four Noble Truths. But if you took one particular sutta out of the Pali Canon and just read it without that context, it probably wouldn't make any sense to you. But because you've heard the teachings over and over again, you know how to apply these. If you haven't read the book yet, it doesn't really matter because now you're going to get an opportunity to develop the understanding of the meditation within that broader framework. So I want to give a brief background to the Buddha's life and why he taught what he taught, and then an overview of the course, and then if you have any questions, and I'll give you your homework assignment for tonight too. So the Buddha was born about 2,600 years ago. He was born a prince in his father's kingdom. There was never one single king of India, but it was ruled by relatively small monarchies all over northern India, and that led to a lot of wars and violence even then. And the political and social climate of northern India at the time of the Buddha's life was very similar to what's going on in the world today. There was a lot of fighting, a lot of aggressiveness, a lot of misunderstandings. And so the Buddha was born into that climate. His father was told when the Buddha was born that your son will either become a great political leader, meaning he'll follow in your footsteps, or he'll become a great spiritual leader. And his father didn't like that idea of his son leaving the kingdom and not following the throne. So he lavished young Siddhartha with everything any kid could want. In fact, he really went overboard. He developed a very cloistered life for Siddhartha, trying to keep him away from the common ills of society, knowing that if his son saw this, he'd probably leave the kingdom, or possibly leave the kingdom, and want to solve all these problems. Even at a very young age, the Buddha was feeling very constricted in this lifestyle, even though he was given every little toy that he could get. There was a 9-year-old at at class Thursday night up in Clinton, and I used the metaphor to create an idea of clinging of a little red fire truck. And the little boy got it, but everybody else, the other adults, got it too, because we can all relate to that. So the Buddha was given hundreds and thousands of little red fire trucks, and he was still unsatisfied. And one day, and the Buddha recounts this later on in his teaching, he was about 5 years old, and he was very frustrated with the day that he was having, and he couldn't understand it, and his mind was creating more and more upset for him. And he just decided that, I'm going to sit down under this tree and calm down, and I'm going to be mindful of my breath. And he noticed, after doing this for a few minutes, his mind calmed down. He wasn't as upset as he was before. And that's significant, and I'll get to that a little bit later. And he went on with his life. And always having this unsatisfactory feeling that he's missing something in life. It can't just be about having all these things. And at the age of 29, for the first time in his life, he left the palace grounds. And for the first time in his life, he saw sickness. He saw people sick on the side of the road. He saw an old man walking with two canes, and he was shocked by this. And then he came across a corpse on the side of the road, which is rather common. Back then, if you died, you know, for a long period of time, you're likely going to lay there until somebody grabs you, either cremates you or buries you. And he was so shocked by this. He had his handler was with him. His name was Chanda. And he says, "Why is that man sleeping on the side of the road?" And Chanda said, "He's not sleeping. He's dead." And that concept had never come across the Buddha's mind before, and he was so shocked by it. And he immediately started thinking, if everybody here on this planet ends up like that poor man on the side of the road, what's the point of any of this? Because up until that point, he was exposed to everything that life has to offer in a way that was significant, that we should be chasing all this great wealth and leading a life of acquisition and competitiveness. And he walked further into town, and he saw the aggressiveness and competitiveness of the townsfolk just trying to eke out a living, trying to survive better than the next person, and that shocked him. And it so impressed on him the ills that he was exposed to that he decided to leave the palace grounds and start wandering around northern India seeking understanding. And that idea of a wandering mendicant means someone who's left the home life behind, was common in northern India, and it's still a rather common practice. Usually after a person has established their family and their business and they're doing okay, maybe in their 40s or 50s, they will take time off from that life and start wandering around and study spiritual teachings. And again, that's still common today. It was accepted form of practice. So the Buddha, at the age of 29, left his wife and his newborn boy, Rahulavada, and started wandering around northern India and seeking understanding, but a very specific understanding. He wasn't wandering around northern India like most of the other mendicants, trying to get an understanding of the great questions. Who am I? Where do I come from? Is there a creator? Is there not a creator? Is the universe finite or infinite? What occurs to one after one's dead? And he started studying with two of the foremost spiritual teachers of his time, Udeka Ramaputta and Alara Kalama. And they both taught variations of their own understanding of the Vedas. So the Vedas are the scriptural teachings that are the precursor to modern Hinduism. And the Buddha studied both of those different variations of the Vedas and mastered them very quickly. And he mastered them so well that both of those teachers invited the Buddha to become their representative and take over their teachings. But the Buddha found those teachings lacking. In a very specific way, they were lacking in developing the understanding of suffering and what his cause was. And they didn't really provide an answer to it either, which is all that he wanted to understand. Of course, when you really look at that, that's the common human problem. He wasn't concerned with great mystical questions or mystical answers. He wanted a practical solution to the understanding of suffering, and if there was a way to bring that to cessation, how to do that. So he rejected both of those teachings, and he continued wandering around northern India. He met five other fellows who were practicing ascetics. And that's a common practice today, too. There's many ascetics. You can see them all over northern India and other parts of the world. And the thinking is that if you deny the physical body, if you deny all the basic needs and all the constant need for sensory fulfillment that a body has, you'll free your mind from the body. And there was actually believed that there was some value in actually doing that. As the Buddha started developing this understanding, he realized that you can't do that because we are one being. We're a psychophysical being. It took him a while to figure that out. So he was wandering around northern India practicing these very severe ascetic practices with the hope of freeing his mind from his body. And it got to the point where the Buddha had been able to control his breath to such a point that if you saw him, you thought he was dead. He recounted, and he started doing these very severe practices with his nutrition. He was eating one grain of rice or one bean a day. And the Buddha recounts one time when he touched his belly from the front, he could feel his spine. He was so emaciated. And one day he's walking down the road and he passed out from his ill, poor health, and he rolled down a little banquet into a river. And this young girl, Sujata, 11 or 12 years old, saw that and pulled him out of the river and nursed him back to health. Gave him some rice and mixed with some milk. And as he started regaining his health and his ability to think clearly, he realized that severe ascetic practice was an extreme practice. It was based in an extreme view. And it would not and could not lead to the reason why he was doing all this, to understand suffering. And he rejected that. And he also, from his childhood, in the first 29 years of his life, he knew that constant sensory fulfillment and constant sensory indulgence was not the answer either. That was another extreme view. And so out of that frustration of all this time and effort that he's put into this practice and developing understanding, he developed a strong intention, or the right intention, to sit in meditation until he developed understanding. And he spontaneously remembered that meditation method that he used when he was a five-year-old boy, that he simply remained mindful of the sensation of breathing and his mind calmed. And he decided to do that with that right intention until he awakened. And so the story, and this isn't really clear whether he sat for one day or 40 days, and the length of time isn't important. What is important is what occurred during that meditation. And during that meditation, he recognized every self-referential view, every view that was formed in a very specific type of ignorance, recognized them as impermanent views and impermanent attachment to objects, events, views, and ideas. And as each and every one of these views arose in his mind, he recognized the impermanence of them, he recognized the I-making or conceit in them, and rejected them. It came back to the sensation of breathing. In the Pali Canon, his confused and deluded thoughts that arose in his mind during that meditation is portrayed using the metaphor of Mara, this benevolent god that kept coming at the Buddha during his meditation, with the hope that Mara would be able to dissuade Siddhartha off his cushion. Of course, that is just metaphor for what was arising in his own mind. And over the course of this meditation session, he recognized and abandoned every self-referential view. And over the course of that meditation, his mind continued to deepen, his concentration deepened, and he was clearing his mind of the clutter that he had been carrying around and accrued since for the first now 35 years of his life. And one day, as the morning star was rising in the sky, the Buddha noticed that. And if you think about, if you're watching the morning star rise, what is it? It's an exercise in impermanence. He looked up, he noticed that, and his mind finally cleared. And he awakened. Now, for the next 2 weeks, he continued his meditation practice off and on, considering if there is a way to actually teach other humans in an effective way, in a realistic way, what he had now understood. And what he was considering was, is there a way to teach what I now know that will pierce the common human problem of that veil of conditioned thinking, the veil of ignorance? Modern psychiatry calls this confirmation bias today. We're biased towards seeing things in a way that confirms the view that we already hold. And if that view is already rooted in ignorance, then that view can only continue ignorance. So the Buddha awakened to what's called dependent origination. It's up on the chart. Dependent origination says from ignorance, a very specific type of ignorance, through 12 observable causative links, all matter of confusion, delusion, and suffering arises. And that very specific ignorance is ignorance of four noble truths. And they're called noble truths because like a noble family continues to rule throughout generations, hopefully forever, but that never lasts, but these have. These are noble truths in the fact that they are just as truthful and useful today as they were 2,600 years ago. They withstand the test of time. When the Buddha first started teaching, let me go back just a little bit. So to get over this, the common human problem of conditioned thinking, he developed the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is presented specifically to overcome the problem of conditioned thinking. And that's why it's called the path. It's the path from ignorance to wisdom. The path from a life of confusion, delusion, and unsatisfactory experiences to a life of lasting peace and happiness. And it's the only path the Buddha ever taught. And I just emphasize that because what has developed in the 2,600 years are a lot of different paths, so-called Buddhist paths, often very contradictory, often very confusing. And I'm not putting down any of them. That's just the way it is. Every religion has had its own adaptations and accommodations, and the Buddhist teachings are just like that. He taught a very, very specific and simple way for any human being who undertook this path to develop an understanding of the general unsatisfactory nature of life, the distraction of a conditioned mind, and how to put all of that aside through a meditation practice that's rooted in developing concentration and then developing the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. So the Buddha's very first teaching was not dependent origination. In fact, he didn't teach that for at least months and probably a couple years into his teaching career. And the reason why is that we need a proper context to understand that. And the proper context is the Four Noble Truths. So it's ignorance of Four Noble Truths that leads to all manner of confusion, delusion, and suffering. So it's developing an understanding of the Four Noble Truths that ends that process. So his very first teaching was a Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta that he presented to those five buddies that he was wandering around northern India with. Now these five friends of his had now rejected the Buddha as someone because they saw him eating meat and eating food again. And they said, well, he's leading this luxurious life. He can't help us anymore. He's gone. But they noticed as the Buddha had gotten up off his meditation cushion, he's walking down the road, and they see him coming, and they talk to each other. He says, we don't want it. We're going to shun him. We're going to turn our backs on the Buddha. He's not one of us anymore. He's given in. He's given in to sensory fulfillment. But they're watching him walking down, and they notice the countenance of this now awakened human being. And they couldn't deny that there was something different about their friend Siddhartha now. And so as he got a little closer, they noticed the way that he was carrying himself, and they didn't understand that he was now fully mindfully present in his life. But it so impressed them that they decided to listen to him. And he presented this first teaching on the Four Noble Truths. Upon hearing this very brief teaching, it probably only took him 20 minutes to describe his understanding. One of the followers, one of his buddies, Kandana, heard this teaching. He understood it completely. He understood it profoundly. And he said to the Buddha, all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. And the Buddha said, he didn't use this, but I like to use the word, bingo. You got it. You understand. I don't think he said it anyway. I'd be surprised. I don't think there's a Pali word for bingo, but bingo, you got it. And he says, you are now Anakandana. Ana, in that sense, means the one who understands. You are now the one who understands. And what Kandana understood was that all external things in the physical world, including his physical body, are temporary. All conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. But what he deeply penetrated was that each and every one of his thoughts and each and every one of his self-referential views are subject to cessation. They're impermanent and subject to cessation. He understood his own impermanence. And he understood the futility of trying to continue to establish a fixed and permanent self in this environment. And that really is the key teaching. That's the foundational teaching, that every one of my views are conditioned views rooted in a very specific ignorance of Four Noble Truths, and they can only lead to further confusion, delusion, and suffering. As we develop the Eightfold Path, we start changing that view from an ignorant view, lacking understanding of the Four Noble Truths, to a right view that understands the Four Noble Truths. So when the Buddha described an awakened, fully mature human being in relation to the First Noble Truth, they are suffering, and this makes complete sense when you look at it, he described that view as a view that completely understands the nature of suffering. And so why wouldn't that be? If that's what the Buddha's teaching is about. Many people will say, well, okay, you know, why? What's so important about that? Until we realize that most of us have, as human beings, rooted in that ignorance of Four Noble Truths, spend our lives chasing after those things that give us pleasure and create identities over those things that give us pleasure. I like this. And we do everything we can to avoid anything that will create disappointment or an unsatisfactory experience. I don't like that. And we form an identity over these likes and dislikes. And we also create an indifference over those things that do not get our attention. And that's where most of life occurs. We become ignorant of those things that do not give us a charge, one way or the other. The root of ignorance is ignore. And we create a conditioned thinking that naturally ignores anything that doesn't continue that self-referential view. Is that clear? So again, the Buddha's Eightfold Path is to recognize those conditioned thinking and fat and thought fabrications, and put them aside. So the Eightfold Path is specifically designed to recognize and abandon conditioned thinking. The first factor of the Eightfold Path is right view. Initial right view is a simple acceptance that something seems to be missing in my life, just like the Buddha felt when he was 5 years old and onward. Maybe I don't know everything. Maybe my views aren't completely correct. That's opening the door just enough to get in and start developing the Eightfold Path. And profound right view is, as I just described, a view that completely understands stress. Then the Buddha continued with describing right view in relation to the Four Noble Truths. Right view is a view that has recognized and abandoned the problem of craving and clinging, individual craving and clinging. Craving originates and clinging perpetuates suffering, the Second Noble Truth. Right view, as it relates to the Third Noble Truth, is a view that has experienced the cessation of suffering. The Fourth Noble Truth is that cessation of suffering is possible. Right view, as it relates to the Fourth Noble Truth, is a view that has developed and fully integrated the Eightfold Path. The Fourth Noble Truth is that the Eightfold Path is the path leading to the cessation of suffering. Excuse me. So the next factor of the Eightfold Path is right intention. If the Second Noble Truth is that craving originates and clinging perpetuates suffering, then right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. Makes sense, doesn't it? The third factor of the Eightfold Path, in fact, the next three factors are called the virtuous factors of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And this is where the Buddhist teachings start having a similarity to most religions. Most religions teach a moral, ethical, and virtuous way of living our lives. And so it's just as important in the Buddhist teachings as it is in other religions. But for a subtly more important reason, it's by becoming mindfully aware, moment by moment, where our thoughts, words, and deeds are in relation to right speech, right action, and right livelihood, that we can recognize and abandon craving and clinging. In other words, if we're holding in mind right speech, and we recognize that in this moment I'm gossiping about someone, since we have that framework, we can recognize that and practice restraint, stop gossiping, and hopefully train ourselves to not gossip in the future. That sounds also pretty simple, and why put all this effort into stopping gossip until we realize that it is in those hurtful behaviors that manifestations that of my self-referential views are coming out. In other words, anytime I'm gossiping about someone, it has to come from a self-referential view, doesn't it? I'm trying to elevate myself over this person that I'm gossiping about. And there's other aspects of right speech, such as being dishonest. Speech that is intentionally hurtful is wrong speech. Speech that is unnecessary or idle chatter is a form of wrong speech. And if you think about that, isn't idle chatter just using the words and what's occurring right now for further distraction? It's taking me out of this moment. Often the Buddha would be asked these questions. that did not deserve an answer. He would simply sit in quiet, not to ignore the person, so that person would directly understand this question is of no significance. Let go of the question. It's okay to just sit and be quiet. It's an aspect of right speech. When you don't have anything that's useful to say, keep your mouth shut. It greatly simplifies your life, for one thing. And it avoids you from getting entangled in things that are, the Buddha would call, a thicket of views. Right action and right livelihood follow in the same way. And basically what it comes down to, if our thoughts, words, and deeds are hurtful to others or towards ourselves, or do not contribute something to the common good, stop. Don't do it. And again, you can see how that will greatly simplify our lives and allow us to remain and deepen our concentration. If on our cushions we're engaged, the more we're engaged in the unskillful or wrong side of wrong speech, action, and livelihood, our minds are simply going to be too distracted and too agitated to meditate. So there's a very practical reason to look at that. And it's interesting to me to notice how many my students, whether here or online through the book, find right speech kind of the entry point to the Eightfold Path, because it's the first time that we're able to recognize our self-referential behavior. And that's really significant. It's important to recognize that initial foray into the Eightfold Path, to see how it's working in your life. The sixth factor of the Eightfold Path is right effort, and right effort simply states that we have to put some effort into actually meditating. You can't just think about meditating, you have to actually do it. And then another aspect of right effort is putting the effort in to develop each factor of the Eightfold Path, an understanding of that. And it doesn't take a lot of effort, but because we have conditioned thinking, there's initial resistance to anything that we're unfamiliar with. One of the reasons why I talk about that so often in class is just to repeat it over and over again. To reemphasize the importance of developing the Eightfold Path as your framework for practice. The next factor of the Eightfold Path is right mindfulness. And by using the term right mindfulness, the Pali word, I can't think of it right now. The Pali words, when they're translated from the ancient Pali to English, there's often no direct correlation. So a good translator will present a very close approximation, taking into understanding their understanding the entire context of what the teachings are supposed to be. So it's important that a translator also knows what the intent of the Buddha's teachings were. The translation will be useless. So two of the best translators are Thanissara Bhikkhu and Bhikkhu Bodhi. Those are the ones that I read most. I know some Pali, but not much. So the Pali word that I can't think of right now, that is, it's usually translated to right view or right speech, just as appropriate would be skillful as opposed to unskillful, or appropriate as opposed to inappropriate. So inappropriate mindfulness or unskillful mindfulness or wrong mindfulness would be holding in mind something that is hurtful. So mindfulness means to recollect or to hold in mind. And we can do that with anything. For some reason, I always go back to Dr. Oppenheimer, who one of the creators of the atomic bomb, because he talked about this later on. It took great concentration and great mindfulness to hold the things that he needed to hold in mind to create the atomic bomb, along with some other scientists. And you know, we can still debate whether it was good or bad. But even after many years later into his life, Dr. Oppenheimer said this was probably a horrible thing to do. And I'm just using that as an example. He was able to hold in mind something that led to that, for most people, incredible devastation. And something that's kept us on the brink for all these years, too. Another maybe practical way is from my own experience. I'm a recovered alcoholic and drug addict. When I was using and drinking, I practiced mindfulness constantly, 24/7. I could not get out of my thinking process the next drink or the next drug. That's mindfulness. It's incredibly hurtful and potentially deadly mindfulness. And I'm using it just to make a point. We can hold in mind things that are hurtful, or we can hold in mind things that help develop the Dhamma. So the Buddha taught right mindfulness in two applications. One is the four foundations of mindfulness that I'll talk about in just a minute. And the other was to be mindful of each factor of the Eightfold Path. To be able to hold in mind those factors as a framework for how we're living our lives. The eighth factor of the Eightfold Path is right meditation. Again, you could use the word skillful meditation, appropriate meditation, but it's the meditation method that the Buddha used and taught for 45 years of his life, and it's what we use here, shamatha vipassana meditation. And he taught that meditation for one singular purpose, right? Maybe not one, but a primary purpose. There's other minor applications of meditation that I won't talk about today, but the primary reason the Buddha taught meditation was to develop concentration. And if you think about the common human problem of ignorance that drives that conditioned mind to distraction, concentration is the most important factor of that, to start putting aside all conditioned views. We need to find a way, we need to find a method to stop that constant need for a self-referential view, to seek further self-referential views, to cling one thought to another. That's a lack of concentration. We've all had that feeling that we can't stop our thinking. Many people call it monkey mind. In fact, it's probably one of the reasons most of us have come to meditation, because we feel like we can't quiet our mind. We have no real control over our thinking. That's clinging one thought to another thought, when it feels like our mind has gotten away from us. We can't stop that. One thought to the next thought, to the next thought. That's a clinging mind. That's clinging thoughts to the next thought. It's a lack of concentration that results in that. The meditation method that we started our class with, recognizing that you're caught up in your thinking again. Come back to the sensation of breathing. You're interrupting in a very direct way conditioned thinking. Many people describe that as meditation creates spaciousness. Well, it actually does in a very practical way. There's a little more space between one thought and the next thought. And it's in that little space that awakening can occur. And as we deepen our meditation and deepen our concentration, we're able to recognize all self-referential views, because we're no longer reacting to those views, and do what Siddhartha did during his meditation, recognize them and abandon them. Sometimes the word is renunciation, renounce them. And it really is that simple and direct, but again, we need the entirety of the Eightfold Path to develop that framework for understanding. So, the book is laid out, and we'll follow this, you know, follow the book. The first lesson is on shamatha vipassana meditation. And I've been questioned a few times, and it's a great question. If the Buddha awakened to dependent origination, why don't you teach? Why don't I present dependent origination first? And the reason why is for the same reason the Buddha didn't teach it, because there's not enough context to really understand what it means. Anybody can understand the words from ignorance through 12 links. Ignorance arises, or suffering arises, okay, you know. But how to apply it, really, you don't have any context yet. So I don't teach dependent origination until week 8. And even then, some people say it's too early. So meditation is the first thing that we need to develop a skill of. So you can see the Eightfold Path as specific skills to develop so that specific tasks can be accomplished, right? So the first skill we need to develop is to start learning how to deepen our concentration. And from the very first minute we use this very effective meditation method, we're deepening our concentration. And one of the reasons why I say that is if you remember that meditation is primarily for deepening concentration, and we do that by recognizing when we're caught up in our thoughts and come back to the sensation of breathing, that meditation is both of those components. It's not just being mindful of your breath. If you remember that, then every meditation is successful and effective, and there's no reason to get frustrated, no matter how many times we have to come back to our breath. Because every time we come back to our breath, we're deepening our concentration. Somebody asked me a while ago, and it was the first time that I've ever thought about it and was ever asked it, so how long are you mindful of your breath in meditation? And I wish I could say for 30 minutes, but I can't. And I've honestly never, it really took me aback, because I don't know. And I really haven't thought much about it since I asked the question, except to give a useful answer. It was maybe 3 or 4 minutes, maybe 5. But because that's unimportant to me, I don't really think about it. What's most important is to use the method as presented to deepen my concentration. So whether it's just for a moment or 2 or 5 or 20 or 30 or 40, it really doesn't matter. What's most important is to use the meditation method wherever you are, whatever the state of your mindfulness is, to deepen your concentration. And it's as that concentration deepens that we're able to hold in mind or develop the refined mindfulness of the other seven factors. And so meditation, Shamatha Vipassana meditation, supports the development and the integration of the other seven factors. And as we integrate the other seven factors, that supports our meditation practice. It's a very holistic and synergistic practice. It's not really linear. We start with meditation, but very quickly we start introducing the other factors that the Buddha taught that are part of the Eightfold Path. So the second week is on the four foundations of mindfulness. The four foundations of mindfulness are to be mindful of the breath in the body, and we do that as soon as we meditate, right? Be mindful of your breath. What you're doing is initially, you're simply bringing your mindfulness into what's occurring right now. Your mind is no longer distracted to the past or to the future or what's going on in the outside world. Be mindful of your breath and your body, and you're bringing yourself into the present. You're bringing yourself into what's occurring in your life right now. And during meditation, hopefully not much else is going on. But the Buddha recognized that for all of us human beings, what's likely to occur is once we become mindful of the sensation of breathing, is the next factor, the next foundation of mindfulness, feelings arise. And the Buddha's teaching this very obvious and probably mundane observation on life. Why? To develop a dispassionate response to our feelings rather than reacting to them. In other words, he's saying, once you become mindful of the sensation of breathing in your body, notice if feelings will arise. We're human beings. Feelings will arise. But what he's saying is to simply be mindful of that process and don't react to it. The next foundation of mindfulness is to be mindful of thoughts arising. Again, it's a common human occurrence. Meditation is not to develop a trance-like state or to mask the appearance of thoughts. I could teach you all a meditation method that does that in 2 minutes, and the reason why I don't is it's not useful. In fact, it's a contradiction to the teachings. The point of meditation is to not be distracted by our thoughts. So we quiet our minds, and we start noticing that feelings arise. If we have a well-concentrated mind, those feelings will arise and fall away, and thoughts will arise and fall away. And like Khandana, when he first heard it, will recognize that all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. If we're reacting to feelings, I just remember that hurt that I had. I had an argument with someone today. And the next thought, the feeling drove the thought, that SOB, how could he act, blah, blah, blah. The mind starts going. Or it might be a thought of, I'm getting my brand new car tomorrow. And the feeling is happiness. And that leads to, wow, you know, maybe I should have got a white interior and black interior. Maybe I should have got white walls. Again, we're distracted by our own thoughts. The feeling drives the thought. Sometimes the thought initiates the feeling. But when we get caught up in the feelings and the thoughts, instead of mindfully and dispassionately observing the process, our minds become confused and distracted. That's the fourth quality of mindfulness. And when I give that instruction at the end of our meditation, notice the quality of your mind, that's what I'm referring to. Notice the quality of your mind. So if we're in dispassionate control of that process, again, this is what meditation teaches us, to have feelings and thought arise without reacting to them, we're able to maintain a calm and peaceful and well-concentrated mind. And that fourth foundation of mindfulness shows us that. The quality of my mind is at peace. If we're reacting to our thoughts and our feelings, we'll be able to recognize that my mind is agitated. Notice the quality of our mind. And even at that point, you've heard me say, we can learn to be at peace with a less than peaceful mind state. Because it's simply what's occurring. We don't need our mind in this present moment to be any different than it is. It's simply what's occurring. So the four foundations of mindfulness teach us primarily what to do in meditation as thoughts and feelings arise. Come back to the sensation of breathing. Be dispassionate about what arises in meditation. And as we teach ourselves and train ourselves to do that on a cushion, we can then do it off our cushion. And for most of us, that happens pretty quickly. We start noticing that we're not quite as reactive as before. That's a direct and immediate benefit of meditation. And as we can remain dispassionately mindful of on our cushion, we're able to do it off our cushion and deepen that refined mindfulness that allows us to hold in mind all factors of the Eightfold Path. So that's the second week. The third week we get into a direct learning of the four Noble Truths. The next 3 weeks are devoted to the Eightfold Path. The first 2 weeks are called the wisdom aspects of right view, right intention. The next three are the virtuous factors of right speech, action, and livelihood. The fifth week is on the concentration factors of right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. The next week begins the teachings on anicca, anatta, and dukkha, the three marks of existence, impermanence, and the not-self characteristic and resulting dukkha. And I think I did this last year. There's a lot there, and I'll probably split that into 2 weeks. The next week is on dependent origination and the five clinging aggregates. Again, I think I'll split that into 2 weeks. The week after that is on karma and rebirth. And just to introduce that now, just to get you thinking about it, if you haven't been through it yet, karma is another one of those things that has been misunderstood and misapplied. The popular way is karma is punishment. It's some kind of punishment system that the universe has for us. Excuse me. Kind of like I had a bad day, so I had bad karma. Or you might look at your life as a difficult struggle, and you act like you have a dark cloud hanging over you. That has nothing to do with karma, or maybe very little. Karma simply means the present moment unfolding of our past intentional actions moderated by the present level of our mindfulness. So what that means is as we're able to develop the Eightfold Path and we're able to see ourselves in relation to what's occurring in a mindful way and cease a distracting or reactionary response to life, we're able to direct what's occurring towards awakening rather than continue reacting based on ignorance and continue confusion, delusion, and suffering. That's the important understanding of karma. Karma is all about action and about change. The word karma means action. So what am I doing right now in my life to continue further awakening, continue my life moving towards full human maturity, or continuing ignorance and the development of further confusion, delusion, and suffering? That is the importance of the so-called present moment. There's no such thing as a present moment, anything fixed in time, that is useful to human beings. What's important to understand about karma and rebirth is that each moment holds the potential for furthering confusion, delusion, and suffering, or to develop full human awakening, each and every moment. And that's the important teachings on rebirth. Rebirth is not taught so much by the Buddha, and this is a lot of the Vedas, what the Buddha taught and rejected, have much to do about the future lives and future births that we're creating. So much so that the emphasis is put on current behavior and rituals that will develop more pleasant future births, rather than developing a life in this lifetime of lasting peace and happiness. And that's the primary reason why the Buddha rejected those teachings. He wanted to find a way for himself and for all human beings to live a fulfilling and meaningful life now, in this life. So while the Buddha does teach in a very cursory way future lives, he also taught that that is not important. What's most important is what's occurring in your life right now. What's most important is this human life. Because in a sense, it's the only human life that you'll have, meaning this self-referential view. If each moment holds the potential to incline my mind towards awakening or continue confusion, delusion, and suffering, then what's most important is what I bring to this moment to give birth to a life that is more prone towards awakening. That's the potential in rebirth. What am I going to give birth to in the next moment of my life? What am I holding in mind? Because what I hold in mind now, what we all hold in mind in the present moment, is going to determine the experience we have in the next moment and the experience we're going to have in our next life. That's why changing our thinking is the primary purpose of the Buddha's teachings, because as we change our thinking and change our point of view, our experience in our own life changes, and the experience of ourselves in relation to our life changes. We cease creating self-referential views. The next week is on hindrances to practice, and that's almost anticlimactic after all of that kind of deep study. But it's also very important, because what happens for many people even after you get through the course and you've developed a pretty realistic understanding of what the Buddha taught, is that you still have that remnants of conditioned thinking and you still want more. So a hindrance to practice can be just that I feel like I still need to be studying more and learning more techniques, rather than realizing that this incredible teaching that was first presented 2,600 years ago and is still available to us today in its pure form is not enough. It is enough. Once you get to that point, be satisfied with it. And then the hindrances get into specific ways that our conditioned thinking tries to continue ignorance rather than continue this path. So that's the overview of the course. Your homework this week is to read the introduction in Shamatha Vipassana Meditation, that first chapter. And there's instructions at the end of each chapter, if you were taking this as a correspondence course with me, that you could write me an email asking any questions and have some observations about what you've learned, and it gives me an opportunity to respond. If you want to do that and bring that back to with you, either write it down or just remember any questions or comments, and then we'll talk about that next week. So that's your homework. And then next week I'll introduce the four foundations of mindfulness, and that's how the course will progress.
And part of the homework, practice Shamatha Vipassana meditation.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah, and you might want to try meditating a few times in the meditation.
This is the small yellow pamphlet.
No, it's the larger book out there.
The larger book.
Yes, and we can talk about that before you leave tonight. It's not necessary to have the book, but it would certainly be helpful because there's articles on the website that relate to each chapter of the book. But we'll talk about that before we leave. So if you're just starting out your meditation practice, short periods of meditation, consistency is much more important than length of time. And if you can do that twice a day, that's the best way to develop your practice. Don't leave anything else. Let's just go around the room, and I want to see how your meditation practice. I didn't eat breakfast today. I get up every day to meditate at 5 o'clock, and sometimes I lay down on the couch again if the dog lays on top of me, I fall asleep. And I woke up 7:15, the dog is licking his head. Isn't it time for you to go to class? Thanks. Kevin, good to see you this morning. How's your practice going? Any questions or comments?
Trying to stay consistent. I'd like to get the evening practice going again. Staying consistent with it. And we're grateful for the talk, and thank you for teaching the course.
You're welcome. Glad you're here.
And one other thing I would say, this is the newsletter. It's a good thing to sign up for, too, right?
Yes.
Keep it in mind, right?
It's one. Thank you for
Thanks
saying.
For
it's
that.
One of the reasons why I send it out on Mondays and Fridays usually, is to just kind of remind you what we're doing here, and also to point out what each class will have. And I usually have a link back to an article that a class will be based on. And also at this time of year, if there's any cancellations because of poor weather, I'll send an email out. And also posted on the website. So if you don't get it, it's a good idea to sign up for it. Thank you. Anthony, good to see you.
I'm pretty consistent lately with meditation, and I don't have a lot to say, so I'll probably exercise mobile silence today. But I did want to compliment you on how detailed, informative, and useful your talk was today on just giving a fantastic overview of the Buddha's life and Shamatha meditation and the overview of the course. It was wonderful.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
I've heard it the last time you went through it, but it gets better every time I hear it.
Yeah. It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I feel the same way. It's like on the surface it sounds, they're suffering, okay, so what? But when you really start getting into this, you start deepening your concentration enough to really appreciate what the Buddha taught, it really is incredible, and how simple and direct it is. Thank you. Keith, good to see you this morning.
It's wonderful to see you. So my question to you is my understanding of karma correct, in that karma brought me back here today because of, I get distracted very easily, and although my practice is going well, some things like coming down here, I get a little mindless and do other things, but your wonderful email reaching out to me which, because I gave you my email address, that, and then I also downloaded a Buddhist day app on my phone, which the next morning gave a verse that expressed the importance of the Sangha. And they were both, you know, a little nudge to get back in here, and it is the one thing that seems to be missing is coming down here. So I'm very happy to have this opportunity to come in here, and this is my first time, you know, going through the course live. I don't, you know, listen to it online, but it's really a great opportunity to be able to come down here. But so that is karma.
No.
No.
I wouldn't say it quite that way, that it's karma that got you here, because karma is just a word that describes a condition. It's not like karma has some kind of power of its own.
Okay.
So in a sense, though, it was your past intentional actions that resulted in you getting here. In other words, you took an intentional action to sign up for the newsletter.
Yes.
So in that way it is, you created the possibility within the unfolding of your karma for this to occur. But it wasn't karma that got you here, it was you that got you here. It was your intention, and it's your continued right intention within the somewhat contradictory aspect of your conditioned thinking that says, I don't want to go there, I don't need to do that. And so there is a little conflict there, but it's not karma. It's really a developing right view that got you here, more than anything else. So even at that opening the door level of right view, it's enough to keep you going, you know. But that's your right effort too that got you here. It's important to recognize that. You know, you're doing the work. We're all doing it. Nothing we do, no matter how wonderful of students and dedicated students we are. That's important, but that doesn't give us anything. We actually have to develop the Dhamma. You know, nothing is bestowed on us. So it's a great point you bring up. Thank you. Glad you're here. Eric, good to see you this morning. How are you?
I'm good. I haven't really given it a concentrated effort quite yet. So pun intended. So I plan on getting involved. So thank you for your talk today.
Yeah, good. You're welcome. Yeah, and just, again, you've heard me say it a few times. Start with short periods of meditation and read the chapter. And that's how we develop the Dhamma. You know, and it's not instantaneous, but very quickly you start realizing the benefits, and that's supportive too. The Buddha always uses this word, ahipasiko, come and see for yourself. But what he's emphasizing is you have to see for yourself. You have to experience this to understand the efficacy of it. But once you experience it, then recognize it, like we're just talking about, and that will help help you maintain your intention and motivation. So glad you're here.
Thank you.
Jay, good to see you this morning.
Thank you. John, I'm listening and I'm trying to make sense of what you're saying or digest it in some way. I guess in a comparative religion course way back when, I was told karma was just your accumulated experiences, you know, the sack or the shelves in your mind,
yep,
with all that stuff on it. And I don't know if that's at all accurate or not. I'm also having trouble, I guess, trying to determine, you know, the difference between a good meditation session and a cat nap or an afternoon nap.
Yeah,
because often, you know, I do lie down on the floor with my legs up and kill off my vagus nerve in the back there and, you know, try and relax and, you know, still my mind as best I can, but again, it's a leaner. Am I properly meditating or am I napping?
Two great questions, Jay. I'll answer the first one, the second one first. No, you're not. Napping isn't meditation. Mm-hmm. And if you think about the purpose of meditation is to deepen concentration. Mm-hmm. The posture might be exactly the same, but I mean, I recommend that when you meditate to sit up too, unless you're ill, then it's okay to sit down. But obviously when you're napping, you're not deepening your concentration. In meditation, you're mindful that you're caught up in your thinking, you come back to the sensation of breathing. You normally don't do that when you're napping. So that's the answer. But it's a, you know, it's a common question too, and mostly it's just because it looks the same, but it's not. The other aspect, karma, is what you described as karma is partially it. So you can say that conditioned thinking is an aspect of karma, but it doesn't totally describe karma, or the stuff that we've accumulated in our heads. That's an aspect of it, but it's not a complete description of it, although it's often portrayed that way. It's just a too limited view to be useful. Karma is not something that is fixed. It's not something outside of ourselves. It's simply the present moment unfolding of past intentional action. So you can look at it, even Keith touched on this too. It took an intentional action for you to get here today. Mm-hmm. You had to decide you're going to do something and then follow through. That resulted in you being here. What occurs while you're here, you could sit there and say, well, that guy, he sounds like a complete fool. I'm not going to listen to him. That is your contribution to your present karma, and it will lead to whatever follows from that, meaning you're not going to listen to me because you think I'm a fool. And maybe you're right. Or your present moment mindfulness might be, wow, that guy is incredibly brilliant. You'd be right about that. And so I'm going to listen to him. In that, it's the same moment that unfolded. But do you see where your mind is going to be inclined now towards listening to me? Hopefully that's valuable or not. That's the potential in each moment. That's the most important thing to understand about karma and rebirth. So if you decide to listen to an incredibly brilliant teacher like me, then you'll develop awakening, hopefully. And if not, you'll continue ignoring me, of an aspect of ignorance, ignoring what I really said, not be so silly, and follow the Buddha's teachings, not this teaching, not me, and you'll continue towards awakening, or ignore the Buddha's teaching, ignorance, and continue confusion, delusion, and suffering. That's what's important to know about karma and rebirth. It's not something that's fixed in stone, nothing is, and it's not something that determines our future, even the next moment, unless we continue ignorance. So again, understanding the Dhamma is also a way of ultimately bringing the effects of karma to conclusion. In other words, no longer be driven by our past intentional actions, because we're simply remaining mindful and calm. We're not contributing to anything anymore. And that's something that, you know, is not even that important to consider, just to know that that's what we're doing. So did I bring any clarity to...
Yeah, and I didn't want you to get any kind of an impression that I thought that you were anything but a wise teacher. Self-deprecation, you know, is only one of my favorite things, and the way to make people laugh or whatever.
Oh, I know.
Break the moment, break the tension. But I feel better after I listen to you talk and after the sessions. So I'm not sure exactly why in particular, but I feel more relaxed and better. So the result, maybe after the 10 weeks I'll start to understand the process more, but the result is sufficient for me right now. You know, feel more relaxed, feel a little better.
Yeah, and that really is it. You know that it works. Again, that's the Buddha kept saying that. He said, don't listen to me. Mm-hmm. Put this into practice and see for yourself. Ahead, Pasiko. You know, so thank you for saying that. Yeah, I know you're just, and I'm just kidding. I know how humble I am. I know.
Yeah.
I know. Lisa, good morning. It's good to see you.
Yeah, we both got here.
Yeah.
Meditation. Sometimes I just have to breathe. I have a lot of anxiety and depression in my life, and when, you know, sometimes when I can, it gets out of hand. I just call it, I just need to breathe now.
Yeah.
And then concentrate on breath in, breath out. So I guess I don't really have a meditation practice right now. I thought I did, because I would call it meditating for 20 minutes on a slam board, but I'm not sitting up. I'm in an inversion, which is very calming, and listening to a guided meditation, or not, or just going through meditation techniques.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really have a practice, but I do know that breathing is very calming.
Yeah.
And I know about your mind wandering and coming back to the breath.
That's meditation. You have a meditation practice then.
Yeah. A little bit.
Yeah.
And so this is sort of a whole new world, and I have trouble learning things. it takes a while. It takes me a while, and this is a lot. This is probably you know, a lifelong process. It's a whole world, and a lot of things you're talking about, you know, over time, you know, have been, you know, distilled by popular culture.
Yeah.
You know, good. Oh, that person has good karma. You know, a lot of the things people don't. I don't really know what they actually are. And so it's this huge, you know, world that you're introducing. And I just have to accept that I don't understand it in the least.
I think you understand it a little bit more than you're saying. but you're right. And you're not unique in feeling that way. It's, again, it's an aspect, a common aspect of conditioned thinking to resist something that we're just unfamiliar with. So the teachings aren't really all that difficult to understand, but because they often contradict our held views, it seems difficult. Again, that's why I say the most important aspect of the Dhamma is to begin with being very gentle with yourself, because you're going to come up against very views that seem very important for you to maintain. And recognize, just like Khandana, this is an impermanent view. It's based on something impermanent. Let it go. Come back to your breathing. Meditation is just what we described here. Whether you're doing it on a slant board or sitting, and I would suggest to just try meditation just sitting, even if it's just for 2 or 3 minutes. But if you find that the slant board seems helpful, that's fine too. What's most important is you develop a way to use this method to deepen your concentration. And then over time, and it won't take all that long, you'll develop an understanding of the broader framework. That's why I taught the course, but that's also why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path. He didn't just teach meditation. Because he understood that it's more than just meditation. We have to find a way to look at and recognize self-referential views. And that's really it. But it takes time to do that. So
what meant a lot is when you said about there's meditation and then there's mindfulness, and the mindfulness is putting the meditation in context.
Yes.
You know, that meant a lot to me. I don't know if I understood it, but it explained a lot of things.
Yeah.
Somehow I can't describe it. You know, like you can meditate, but you need that context of mindfulness.
Yeah.
It just meant something to me.
Yeah, I'm so glad you got that, because the way mindfulness is presented today, it's usually or often presented as mindfulness meditation. Meaning that meditation develops mindfulness. But it's better to look at it that meditation is a skill to develop so that you can accomplish the task of refined mindfulness, developing refined mindfulness. Meaning learning how to apply what to hold in mind. What to hold in mind is the Eightfold Path. You know, that's how we apply mindfulness. Meditation supports that mindfulness, but it's really two different things. So mindfulness is a quality of mind. I would say great insights, Lisa. Thank you for those questions and comments. Eva, good to see you this morning.
Wonderful to be here. Truly grateful for this environment that you've created for us and the place where we can be reminded of how important the Sangha really is. Yeah. I had, I don't know how long I've been coming here, a few years, but I had a period where I stopped coming for a while, and I chose to because I thought that I could continue doing this on my own, but it really does make a difference to be here and to share with everyone. So thank you very much, sincerely, for this environment. As I said, I've been coming here many, many years, and I went through the whole course, and now everything that you said is almost like brand new, or it's filtering in different ways that hadn't filtered before, and so it just requires repetition, because we get our strengthening here, and then we go out there and we're confronted with all these different things, and it's so easy to forget and to get caught up and to really forget or to lose the context of it, and then it helps to, oh yeah, that's why this is important, or that's why this now makes more sense. I got up to this point, but now I've got this other information that I can now make it bigger, and I still don't understand a lot.
Thank you. As you were talking, I was thinking about my own development of the Buddha's teachings from when I first came across what the Buddha actually taught. And you know, with what's that, the bell curve. As I started developing the Buddhist teaching in relation to everything else that I thought the Buddha was, the complication part of the bell curve went, you know, was going higher. I was getting more and more confused. And then, if the bottom of the other side of the bell curve is utter simplicity, that's where it took me to. But it took me a while to really appreciate the utter simplicity of what the Buddha taught. But that doesn't mean that it's necessarily easy in relation to conditioned thinking. But the more you refine it, the more you see, oh yeah, this is how it fits. It's just a natural expression of living a life rather than something that I'm adding to me. It's really a process of letting go. The Buddha talked about self-referential views as like foam on an ocean. There's nothing there. You're letting go of something that is completely insubstantial, but when you're letting go of it, it can seem very scary almost. You're letting go of these hardened views, but ultimately it's just a way of simplifying the way we think. Thank you. Diane, good to see you this morning. It is something. It is something. You remind me of a book I read years ago by one of my favorite authors. His name is Og Mandino, and he was a spiritual success writer. He wrote, if you heard of him, you probably heard of The Greatest Salesman in the World. He wrote that book, but a bunch of others. And one of the books he wrote was called The Choice. And in that book, so Og Mandino was a guy who was kind of like me. He was sleeping on the streets, alcoholic, who solved that problem and developed a very successful life, and he also made an awful lot of money, but he didn't get trapped by it. And one of the things that he wrote about in the Choice is to be very mindful of how seemingly insignificant choices can have powerful effects on our entire life and the people, those people around us. And a simple example would be, I make a choice that I'm going to go to Sangha today. And that seemingly insignificant choice can lead to a lifetime of awakening. And he also wrote in that book that when you get to a certain point in your life and you're satisfied, he's talking about achieving wealth and power, he says, stop. You don't have to keep going. And that kind of relates to the last lesson on hindrances. when you've developed an understanding and you found a Dhamma practice that works, that's enough. Deepen your understanding through the practice rather than trying to add to it. So I kind of got off that point, but each moment holds that potential too of what choice am I making in this moment?
So isn't Diane's example of altering the people population karma unfolding?
Oh, I didn't follow you.
Isn't Diane's example of altering people based on preferences in your life?
Oh,
karma.
Yeah, well, and the throughout the Pali Canon, I often give teachings on the importance of association. Association, just another word for attachment or clinging. And so who we associate with and what we associate with will also determine, to a great extent, the type of life that we're and experience we're going to have. And so there's nothing wrong with recognizing, what's that old, that long poem, The Days of Arada, and it talks about, you know, loud or obnoxious, I can't remember the exact words.
Oh, yeah.
And avoid the, and it doesn't mean that if I find loud and abusive people and I choose to not engage with them in a mindful way, in other words, if I have an opportunity to not be around loud and aggressive people, I'm not. It doesn't mean that I think that they're bad people, but that's important for developing my own understanding, my own peace and happiness. It's what we do in here. Even in the Sangha, there are certain rules that we go by, aren't there? So that it's a peaceful, calm, and non-distracting environment that we have here. Now that's part of it, part of what we associate with. Over the years, there have been many people that have come here and wanted to introduce other teachings as part of what we do here. And not as a way of rejecting those teachings, but it's not appropriate here. And just, in other words, it might be modern so-called Buddhist teachers that teach something completely different than the Buddha taught. Well, it's just confusing. That's why we don't talk about it here. You know? In fact, that's something else that I learned from learning how the Buddha taught. One of the first things that there's three sets of books in the Pali Canon. One is called the Sutta Pitaka, which is the collection of the Buddhist suttas, the teachings. Another is called the Vinaya Pitaka. Vinaya means the rules for monastic living or living within a sangha. And one of the first rules is that when you come together as a sangha, you discuss the Dhamma. Nothing else. He was telling them, you know, back then, you don't want to be discussing the chariot races or anything like that. And in so doing, we're creating an environment that is as distraction-free as it possibly can. And a good example was that for the 4 or 5 weeks after the election, I did not want to talk about the election simply to trying to keep this non-political. But I realized that I had to because so many of us were so upset that we needed a way to put that in perspective. But it would be wrong for me to keep bringing it up like I just did. When we're here as a sangha, we talk about the sangha. And I'm not going to go any further than that. Thank you. And thank you all for getting the joke. Tom, good to see you.
Thank you for the class today. I definitely recognized you do repeat things in the book. And when I was reading it, it's a lot of repetition. And I appreciate that because it helps you remember. And also, the more you hear it and the more you explain it, the more I'm having understanding of it. So definitely all helps. Regarding my practice, it's not where I want it to be. I am meditating, you know, not twice a day, but, you know, usually at least once a day. And I'm definitely able to get, once I'm mindful and I realize I'm caught up in my thought, then I'm able to go back to my breathing. But it's that recognizing that I'm caught up in thought that is the what I'm trying to do better at, I guess, or where my efforts are going to. And that's the less I meditate, the harder it is to do, the more I meditate, the easier it is. And I find that going back to my breath and recognizing that I'm caught up in thought, whether I'm meditating or whether it's my life, and last night I had a very difficult time. I was having a lot of really dark thoughts, and meditation helped a lot because I was able to recognize the thoughts and go back to my breathing. And it was like a 4-hour period of me just in this circle of bad thoughts and go back to my breathing. Bad thoughts. Wow. So it definitely helped out a lot. So that's why I'm here today. regarding karma. I was always thinking karma was a verb. Maybe it's more of an adjective.
Yeah, it can be either one. It depends how you're using it. But it really is just a word, you know. Yeah. And what you just described, that four-hour process, you were using meditation exactly how it was meant to be, in a very practical way. You're interrupting that conditioned, ongoing thought, dark thoughts. And again, that's exactly how it works. And eventually, you're able to break that connection, you know. So we need a way to do that. So thank you for bringing that up. Ellie, good to see you this morning.
Good to be here. My practice is going pretty well. I just added the second meditation.
Yeah, good
so
for you.
I'm going to try to keep that going because that's never happened before.
Wow.
And I did this class last year for the first time, and I read the first chapter, and already it's, you know, I had some aha moments that, you know, I just picked up stuff that either went over my head or just didn't really get for whatever reason a year ago that were really obvious to me now and really profound, I thought.
Yeah.
Just the connection between meditating on the process of meditation and the process of being in the world, and that the meditation is actually mirroring what's happening on the day-to-day, in your day-to-day life, which I never really, I knew they were connected and I knew meditation helped me in my day-to-day life, but I didn't understand that the process of, you know, focusing on the breath and pushing away those thoughts and focusing back on the breath was the same thing as dealing with extreme situations or emotions during the day or at work or at home or whatever. Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
One exactly mirrors the other. And it's probably, you know, the simplest, most obvious thing to get out of that first chapter, but that was very profound for me.
Yeah, thank you for saying it. It's not, for most people, it's not that obvious, but the reason why meditation mirrors what's going on off our cushion is it's the same person.
Right.
And usually off our cushion, we're not aware of that same person as we are when we're present. You know, because we're so distracted. And describing that experience, the aha moments, I think I talked about this a little bit too, though. You now have the context for seeing things. You've developed it. You put a year into this practice. You went through the course. And that's not a long period of time to change your whole thinking, is it? But now you have a context for seeing how to apply it. That's refined mindfulness. That's what I mean when I use that word, refined mindfulness. You've developed enough of the Eightfold Path to see things in relation to the path rather than just random occurrences. You know, you see how to apply the teaching. So, thank you.
Well, I'm sure next year I'll get more out of it than I do this year.
I hope so. And I want to say something else about the second meditation. Almost everybody I've ever taught, including myself many years ago, has difficulty starting and keeping that second sit going. And the second sit does not have to be as long as the first sit, if that's one of the difficult. In other words, if you've developed a 10 or 15 minute first sit and you're having trouble sitting 10 or 15 minutes again 12 hours later, approximately 12 hours later, it doesn't have to be. It could be just 2 or 3 minutes to start getting that second sit going. You know, that's fine if that makes it any easier. What's most important is to do it. And the idea of around 12 hours apart is that's just a nice break in a 24-hour time period. You know, it's a gentle interruption into our conditioned thinking that develops as we're going through our day. You know, again, just a couple of minutes will prove to be very beneficial. So thank you. Debbie, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good to see you. Good morning, everyone. Practice is going pretty well and pretty consistent in terms of the morning sit. Because in the morning I have a better routine.
Yeah.
You know? But once I'm at work and I have such irregular hours and long hours, it's really hard to have a routine.
Yeah.
You know, like sometimes I'm coming home at 10 or 9:30 and sometimes, you know, so it's like, it's really hard to be consistent. But I like the idea of just doing a few minutes. And I do try to do that here and there when I have a break, if I have a break in my day. You know, some days are easier. I just wanted to kind of repeat, talk about repetition. Anthony said that it was really helpful to have the whole kind of history and the whole, you know, to have that introduction, including some of the history, I missed that. Well, I didn't, I came here last year after you completed the course, so, you know, it's nice to kind of start at the beginning.
Yeah.
I always felt like I was kind of doing catch-up, all, you know, since we finished that and I started. So that was just really great to have the whole context. This morning, like that. So cool. I also like the piece about, you know, how you talked about the mindfulness, meditation and the mindfulness, and how they work together.
Yeah.
It was helpful too. I hadn't thought of it quite that way, so that was helpful too.
Thank you for saying that.
Appreciate being here.
I'm glad you're here. The whole course is written in a way to develop the context and to keep things in context. You know, it's really the only way that it makes sense. It has to be in the proper context. But that's true about anything. You know, if you want to learn how to change the oil in your car and you go to school for brain surgery, you know, you might learn something useful, but you can't change your own oil. It's got to be in the right context. You know? So, Mary, good to see you.
It's good to be here. I missed a couple of sessions to volunteer work and interrupting things. It's been good work. I appreciate your going over the book again. I mean, I think that's a book that I could read and reread, and each time I read it, get something more out of it, because it does contain an awful lot of information. And I always appreciate also the talks on the Buddha and going through the suttas. They just make so much sense.
Yeah.
I really do get a lot out of it during a tumultuous time of my life. It's helped me stay on track. So.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, that's a good start. So you all have your homework assignment. There is no grade except your own experience. That'll tell you how you're doing. I think that's it. Let's finish with metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture. And again, gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk today. And in metta, the first object of our meditation is always ourselves. And generating feelings of deep love and compassion for the object of our meditation. May I be filled with love and kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy. May I be filled with love and kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy. May I be filled with love and kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy. And now bring to mind those that you care deeply for. And generating those same feelings of love and compassion for the objects of our meditation. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. And now bring to mind those you may be in conflict with, difficult relationships, and generating those same feelings of love and compassion for the objects of our meditation. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. And now bring to mind each other in this room this morning, and all the other members of our Sangha, and extend your awareness outside of this room, across our community, across our planet, across all creation, to include all sentient beings, and generating those same feelings of deep love and compassion for all sentient beings. May all sentient beings be filled with love and kindness. May all sentient beings be well. May all sentient beings be peaceful and at ease. May all sentient beings be happy. May all sentient beings be filled with love and kindness. May all sentient beings be well. May all sentient beings be peaceful and at ease. May all sentient beings be happy. May all sentient beings be filled with love and kindness. May all sentient beings be well. May all sentient beings be peaceful and at ease. May all sentient beings be happy. And this concludes our Dhamma practice for today. Thank you all for being here. Peace.
Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.